This is the Dairy Download, brought to you by Blumling Associates and the International Dairy Foods Association, where we offer extra sharp market and policy insights on dairy. I'm your host, Phil Plord.
And I'm your co-host, Kathleen Wolfley.
Today's episode is about winning the war on school milk. First, we'll chat with a nutritionist who took his concerns to the pages of the New York Daily News. And then we have a conversation with someone from the dairy industry tackling the issues on the front lines. We'll get to that in a bit. As always, thanks to our listeners. If you enjoy this free podcast being delivered to your inboxes and favorite podcast apps every other week, please, please, please thank our episode sponsor, tell a friend about the show, and leave your review on your favorite podcast app.
Today's sponsor is the Kansas Department of Agriculture. Ready to expand your dairy processing into the premier dairy frontier? There's room to grow in Kansas, the center of it all. Contact dairyinkansas.com.
Okay, Kathleen, where are we now?
Phil, CME prices as of Thursday, May 19th. Block cheddar closed at $2.38, up 7 cents on the week. Barrels finished at $2.40, up a penny. The CME spot butter market closed at $2.83, 12 cents higher, and the non-fat dairy milk market finished at $1.79, up 6 cents. Phil, what do you think the most important thing right now is?
Well, I don't know if you've dared to look at your 401k or your hobby stock portfolio or whatever, but things have not been exactly glowing on Wall Street here lately. I see that today equity markets are up a little bit, but it's been a rough month, to put it mildly. The old saying is sell in May and go away. And here we are, the S&P 500 down 13% on the month, 18% year to date, and 5% versus last year. And I think this is all important because at some point, consumer confidence, which was already a little shaky, consumer spending patterns, which were already threatened a little bit by inflation, and now you have the wealth effect shrinking a little bit. And we're always curious about how that impacts consumer spending and then by extension, demand for dairy products. So back into the laboratory to see what happens when stocks go down 10 to 15%. What about you, Kathleen?
To me, the most important thing is milk production. USDA published their April milk production report this week, which showed output down 1% year over year, which was below industry expectations. Plus, it showed that cow numbers were flat from March to April. While I still think that there's appetite to grow milk supplies here in the U.S. in 2022, I think the report did offer a good reminder that the combination of these base excess programs plus rising input costs across the country could temper some of the speed of expansion.
You know, Kathleen, that plays into my stat of the week. I think another factor in the slower milk production growth is that we don't have a lot of heifers around. And my stat isn't exactly a new one. It harkens all the way back to late January when USDA published its cattle inventory report. But just as a reminder, that report showed that we had 2,836,000 heifers expected to calve in 2022. That was down 3.4% from the year prior and was at the lowest level since 2005. So we may have, where there is appetite for growth and where people can grow, one of the problems we have is that there just aren't as many heifers as there were 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago to make that happen. What's your stat of the week?
My stat of the week is gas prices. I know we've talked about this in the last several episodes, but AAA data as of May 20th showed the national average gas price at $4.59 a gallon. Here in upstate New York, had a little sticker shock this week. The average price is nearing $4.90 a gallon. Just have to wonder, are consumers getting accustomed to these higher prices, or will we start seeing the fact that people are spending more money at the pump mean less money is being spent elsewhere? It's expensive.
Yeah, I think clearly it's the latter. And, thank goodness you didn't buy a diesel for your latest vehicle, because that is that number starts with a 6 in a lot of places.
You know what's funny is I noticed my neighbor traded in his diesel truck for a gas truck here in the last couple of weeks. So it's making a difference.
Most of those trucks don't take 5 gallons, right? I mean, it's 6 times 50 or a big number.
Right.
So do you have a fearless prediction, Kathleen?
Yes, I do. Next week, we see a USDA cold storage report. On average, we see butter stocks increase by about 34 million pounds from March to April. I'm going to take the under, saying that butter stocks will increase at less than the average pace. What's your fearless prediction?
Interesting. I'm going to stick with the butter market as well. We're back up flirting with the 280 mark in the spot market. Has people thinking, well, are we going to $3 butter? I'm going to say I still don't see $3 butter in 2022 for this marketplace. The high for the year so far was 293.5 in early January. I'm not sure if we're not going to make a new high here, but I'm still sticking with that. We will not see $3 butter in 2022.
All right, then. Put it on the books. Well, Phil, let's get to our first guest.
We're delighted to have Keith Ayoub with us today. Keith is a pediatric nutritionist, registered dietitian, and clinical practitioner who served as director of the nutrition clinic at the Children's Evaluation and Rehabilitation Center at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx for over 30 years. He recently published an op-ed in the New York Daily News pushing back against New York City Mayor Eric Adams' proposed ban on flavored milk in New York City public schools. Keith, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Thanks very much. I'm really happy to be here.
So tell us about the work you do in child health and nutrition.
I've been a pediatric nutritionist for many years now, and the center that I work in is a large diagnostic and treatment center for children with special needs. I have a nutrition clinic there, and I did for over 30 years. I still go back every month and, you know, catch up with patients and see new patients. And this is, all my patients are located in the Bronx and in New York, and they are, the vast majority of them are low-income patients and from low-income families. Most are also minority patients, mostly Black and Latino patients. So I'm really, you know, the issue of milk in schools is a really important one for me, because oftentimes this is the most balanced meal these kids are going to get all day.
How does that work intersect with dairy? Is dairy something you recommend or prescribe to children and adolescents as part of their diets?
Oh, absolutely. I recommend dairy. And one of the things that I actually look for when I'm taking a dietary recall or a dietary history, which I do on every one of my new patients, is I look for the things that are most likely to be lacking in a child's diet or, frankly, an adult's diet. And those are things like, are they getting enough fruit? Are they getting enough vegetables? Are they getting enough whole grains? And are they getting enough dairy? Because those are the food groups that I call the food groups of concern. We've all heard about the nutrients of concern, but there are also food groups that are underconsumed. And dairy is a big one. And that's why I guess it really kind of worries me when I hear things like, you know, efforts to diminish dairy intake, because it's an entire food group. I don't understand. So I not only recommend it, but I actually look for it to make sure in their dietary histories that they are getting enough dairy.
And so, yeah, there's plenty of legend and misinformation about dairy's benefits in an overall diet or you know, negatives, I guess. Which pieces of that misinformation, in your opinion, are most harmful for kids in their development? And how do you counteract that? Where are the holes that are being created?
Oh, my God. The holes are like Swiss cheese. I don't think I've ever seen a food group undergo more scrutiny than the dairy food group. And it's ironic to me because I don't think you're going to find, in fact, I know you won't find, at least with milk, a drink for kids or adults that is going to be more packed with nutrition than just plain simple milk. Nothing they're going to get is going to have the nutrient content, the nutrient quality, the nutrient balance that milk does. So it troubles me when people start talking about the misinformation around milk and dairy, and when they want to discourage kids from drinking dairy. This dairy works, you know, and why you want to, you know, minimize that value is just not understandable to me at all. And I do a lot of dispelling of this myth, is that it's full of hormones, at least to my knowledge. Most RBST is kind of out of the supply, more or less. it's pretty much gone. So the idea of saying on a label that this milk does not contain any RBST is kind of a marketing thing. So I don't pay too much attention to it. And frankly, it's a bovine hormone. I don't think it's going to work on you unless you have hooves and a tail. So, you know, I get rid of that hormone issue right away. And then the other thing that crops up, not on, ironically, in my patients, it's not a question from patients, but a question from dairy haters, I guess you'd call them, that minority populations don't digest dairy. And I want to say to them, you know, every single civilization on every continent has in some way, shape, or form used dairy foods. You know, they made use of it. Whether it's goats, cows, sheep, the whole bit, they use dairy products. Okay, most of the time in, you know, historically, it's been in fermented dairy foods or cheese or something like that because that's the way they could keep it. They didn't have refrigeration. And at the same time, they've all used them. So every culture on every continent. And in terms, and as I say, I work primarily with African-American and Latino patients. And if it were that undigestible, I would be getting a lot of those complaints. And I get none. Unless somebody has the rare allergy, but that's the same thing, whether it's an allergy to dairy or milk, or whether it's an allergy to, you know, cucumber. I mean, it's like a no-brainer in terms of what you do. You have to avoid the food, but that's very, very rare. And now there are so many options for allowing people to tolerate dairy. We have not even lactose-reduced milk. We have lactose-free milk. I remember when that first came out, it was just reduced. Now it's pretty much lactose is not an issue if you have issues with lactose. You can get lactose-free milk. You can get filtered milk. There's so many different dairy products that allow people who didn't used to be able to tolerate milk very easily to do so and get back to having the milk the way they like. And you know, one of the things I think milk has suffered from is, and one of the things I actually bring up to my patients, because a lot of them say, oh, they want, they'll bring up a dairy alternative that they have in the house. Oat milk and almond milk are probably the two most common that I hear about. But, there's usually almost no protein in these things, and anything nutritious that's in there had to be added in, had to be built. And ironically, these are the people who often talk about needing to consume fewer processed foods. I said, well, milk is about one of the least processed foods you're going to find. I said, those dairy alternatives are ultra processed. I mean, there's not much, they start out with nothing, and they pretty much have to build out of four almonds. They have to turn four almonds into a glass of milk. And I usually tell my patients, eat the almonds, have your oat. And drink a glass of milk. It's perfectly fine.
Let's talk about school meals. Tell us why they are so important to child nutrition and why dairy is an important component of those meals.
Well, dairy is a really important component because, first of all, most kids are not getting enough calcium and vitamin D. And it's not as simple as, just giving them a supplement or something. Now, also, when we had COVID, for example, it was a big, big problem because these kids counted on that, and their parents counted on their kids getting lunch every day. And it was a big movement to get school meals delivered to homes or to at least neighborhood centers where kids could come and pick it up. Because that's a really balanced meal. Whether kids like it, not like it, whatever, it's a really balanced meal. And to all of a sudden, and the value of school meals was brought to the forefront when all of a sudden kids weren't going to school. Well, what about that meal? And most of our schools also offer breakfast in school. So if kids aren't going to school, they may not get breakfast, they may not get lunch. Or if they do, it probably won't be as balanced as the meal that they're going to get in school because that's regulated. So, those became very much a concern, and milk is present on each of the meals that schools serve, both for breakfast and for lunch. To not get that means those kids probably aren't going to get milk that day. So that's a real concern. Another thing is when, it doesn't worry me if kids don't get a glass of milk today, but when you take milk out of the school or you discourage consumption and school meals are a primary source of both dairy and milk for the day, that's creating a negative habit. that's creating that's sending a message that A, milk isn't necessary, and B, it's not necessary for us to provide it to you. And when they take that message outside the school, that's a real troublesome thing, because we're going to, I'm worried about graduating our kids at grade 12 with 12 years of not enough milk in school, and they're going to get a diploma and lousy bones at the end, you know? So that's a problem. I should say this. I'm saying this podcast with my own glass of milk here. Actually, it's in the form of hot chocolate, but that's mine. I make my own.
As an avid milk drinker, especially as a child, I can tell you I only broke my first bone as a 30 plus year old. So milk does build strong bones.
It does. And I actually, my grandfather was a dairy farmer, but I grew up in that time when pediatricians often told patients, well, you know, milk after age two is not necessary. So it was never prohibited in my house, but we never drank a lot. And I have to tell you, that's unfortunate, because in my history, in my family, both sides, osteoporosis, big time. And not just the women, the men got it.
Let's talk about flavored milk and yogurt, which means milk and yogurt with added sugar. Is this a good thing for kids? Why or why not?
I think the option to have that and have flavored milk and flavored yogurt in school is excellent. And here's why. You mentioned sugar and kids in the same sentence and everybody gets called anxious. I don't. Why? Because even the U.S. dietary guidelines, on every iteration of that, those guidelines that come out every 5 years, there is usually a note that we want to, you know, limit or reduce added sugars. I get it. Believe me, I'm the last person in the world to want to give anybody more like added sugars. I want to cut back on it. However, I always want to say to people who worry about the sugar in flavored milk, I say, well, we are going to have some added sugar in a diet, not a lot. And, you know, and I think it's really important to emphasize there's not a lot of sugar we want to have in diets. On the other hand, when we do have that sugar, that added sugar, where would you spend that sugar? I would spend it to drive the consumption of nutrient-rich foods that are already underconsumed. And milk and yogurt are specific examples. It doesn't mean that kids aren't going to go and drink plain white milk at home in whatever. But in school, it's a different sort. I think you need to give them a choice. And there will be kids who still take white milk, perfectly fine, but give them that choice. And now the sugar content of flavored milk in school is now has been titrated gradually lower. So it's less, you know, it's less sweet than it ever was. Plus, overall sugar intake across the population has been declining for 20 years. So I don't think sugar is the biggest issue in kids' diets. Now, if it is, it's not happening in school, because I think 1% of the added sugar in kids' diets actually comes from school. I'm not worried about that. I'm worried about what's going on in the other 18 hours of their day. And if you don't get flavored milk in school or flavored yogurt, kids are going to end up, they'll learn to adapt, but they won't adapt the way you want. They'll learn to hold their drink until they can get out of school a couple hours later and go right, at least in New York City, they'll go right down to the corner bodega and the corner store and get a 20 ounce or 24 ounce bottle of orange swill that's going to have more sugar, more added sugar in there and no nutrition than a week's worth of flavored milk.
You decide to get engaged with the latest attempt by New York City to ban flavored milk from public schools. What caused you or what prompted you to speak up?
I get a little annoyed when people, anybody starts making or encouraging policy changes that are not grounded in sound science and that don't make sense. Now, it's very easy for politicians to do that on both sides of the aisle, that's fair, because it gets votes and it gets people all riled up and they love that kind of stuff. And I think we need to drive nutrition policy that's based on sound science, not trends. It's very, very hip to ditch tradition and go with something that's very trendy. So all the plant-based alternatives that are out there for dairy and think, oh, this is much more cool. And you see celebrities sometimes talking about, you know, well, they have oat milk at home and they have almond milk they put on their cereal. Great. That's for them. But the kids in my office are going to get information that's grounded in sound science. Forget the trends. Okay. Your body is not a trend. And yes, they are dairy alternatives. But I always tell the parents I work with, an alternative is not an equivalent. Milk is unique. And just because it's an alternative, it's absolutely an alternative. Is it equivalent to milk? No way, no how, not ever. You know, and I think one of the things that milk suffers from is that people don't know that it's local food most of the places. And even in New York City, our milk is local. And with the big push on farm to table and localizing our food supply, I said, you know what? All you really want to do to, all you really need to do to start eating more locally is go buy a gallon of milk. It came from 2 hours away. And that's right in the middle of the biggest city in the country.
If you had a message to other mayors and lawmakers out there looking to ban milk or dairy products, what would you tell them?
I would probably tell any mayor or politician who wants to ban dairy products or even minimize their importance is to really look at the science. Don't look at the trends. Don't look at the votes. Look at the science. And the science is absolutely rock solid on this. Dairy works. It's underconsumed. It contains, or at least milk contains, three of the four nutrients of concern. Are we really talking more about what's trending, or are we talking about the health of kids? And I take the health of kids very seriously, and also the health of families. When you're a pediatric nutritionist, you never have one patient. You always have at least two, the person who's your patient, the child, and the person taking care of the kids. And that's really important to me. So I make my recommendations absolutely based on the credible sound science. And that's what I think ought to drive health policy.
Dr. Ayoub, we really appreciate your time today and all the work that you've done for the nutrition of kids in the Bronx area. Really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Now let's get the industry perspective.
We're so pleased to have Rick Noxey with us today. Rick is CEO at American Dairy Association Northeast. His organization was instrumental in working with IDFA and other dairy organizations earlier this year to educate New York City public school officials about the benefits of low-fat flavored milks. We're excited to dig into the details with him here today. Rick, welcome to the Dairy Download.
Hey, thanks for having me here.
So tell us about the work you lead at the American Dairy Association Northeast and where you fit in all the broader field of dairy associations.
We're one of the national checkoff members, and we do promotion, nutrition, public relations activities for dairy farmers just to promote more sales of milk and dairy products across the board.
And of all that milk that you represent, how much of it do you think ends up in New York City schools?
Well, generally in school marketing, 6 to 7% of the production of milk goes into schools. I know that if you take that in New York City, that means about 90 million half pints or more every year.
That's not a small amount of half pints.
So before we get into the, you know, dive into what happened in New York City early this year, let's back up a few steps. You know, flavored milk has been in the spotlight for some time in New York City. Mayor de Blasio proposed banning flavored milks in New York City schools. And then what happened in 2019?
Yeah, Mayor de Blasio, listening to some of his advisors, decided that they were going to move away from chocolate milk. We heard early on, because we do a lot of work with New York City schools, when we found out, I spoke to all the processors that manage the milk sales for New York City schools. We tried to actually reformulate the milk to try to bring the sugar down as a way to be proactive. But frankly, the industry did that back in the early 2000s, and there wasn't much room to remove much more sugar, and New York City doesn't allow non-nutritives. So it went through that process. We got parents, we got IDFA, others all involved in this process. And in the end, they backed off of that decision to try to go without chocolate milk in New York City schools.
And so, you know, flash forward to today, newly elected Mayor Eric Adams, I mean, different fellow, except he's a vegan, takes the anti or no flavored milk thing and runs with it, proposes his own ban. Was this new ban any different than the one proposed in 2019?
No, it was very similar, frankly. In my career since 2005, that action has been trying to happen in New York City. The biggest difference and my biggest concern is because Mayor Adams was ideologically a vegan, we thought he might be much more adamant about the way he went after this. So I thought it was an even bigger challenge because of that.
IDFA did some polling work that showed 90% of parents in New York City support including low-fat flavored milk in schools. Members of Congress weighed in as well. Tell us what kind of reaction the mayor's proposed ban received from both lawmakers and constituents.
Yeah, let me start out by saying that as a checkoff organization, we're not involved in legislative issues. We depend on people like IDFA to do that work. But I can tell you from the media and the marketplace, many of our legislators weighed in supporting the dairy farmers, supporting the kids, and the fact that they knew that chocolate milk is great for kids because it delivers all the nutrients that they need. But on the other side, the poll that IDFA did really proved to be true, because what we heard from our friends in New York City schools, they had a lot of parents getting a hold of them and saying, you know what? We've got a lot of issues we have to deal with in the city, and chocolate milk is not on the top of our list. We actually believe as parents that chocolate milk is good for our children, and we do not support the ban. So that was great. I mean, your poll proved to be true when the parents got activated.
And so where are we now? Has the mayor backed off his proposed ban? Are we all systems go? Where do things sit?
I know that in the media, I think it was on April 18th, a headline came out saying that he was going to back off from the ban. We never sit back on that kind of thing, though, because it's a constant pressure against chocolate milk. So they did back off of that particular ban, but they're always kind of chipping away at chocolate milk. The health department in New York City has been negative about chocolate milk for a long time. The last time we fought this in 2019, the good news was the state health department was very supportive of us and said that chocolate milk was good for kids. So a little split between those health department groups. But we're always vigilant because we know that they just keep pressing and pressing on chocolate milk.
And so in terms of that vigilance and that engagement, what points are you trying to get across to officials and you know, to convince them that they shouldn't be doing this?
The point we try to make is the 13 essential nutrients in milk are critical to kids growing and their well-being. And there's a trade-off when you have a nutrient-dense product like chocolate milk. You can give up a few calories coming from sugar because of the density of that product and all the kids get from it. So we work with parents. We work with health professionals. Like you talked about, Keith, we have a number of health professional organizations in our region that will support chocolate milk because they see that that balance of nutrients versus a little bit of sugar, it's a plus for kids that they're drinking more chocolate milk.
To sort of a more holistic look at the you know, all right, there's a little sugar in here, but it's coming in a densely nutritional package, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
In your opinion, why did this effort receive attention of American Dairy Association Northeast and IDFA and other dairy organizations?
Well, you've got to remember that nowadays, kids are in many cases receiving 2-3 meals a day at schools. And so besides the volume issue that our farmers care about, we care about the impression that kids have about our product. We want them to be having the opportunity to have that product with the meals. We don't want someone taking that away from us. And so the industry has always responded very strongly to this. Our dairy farmers, for instance, have supported kids very holistically. We do this program called Fuel to Play 60, where we talk about the whole child, not just the dairy interest, but also their physical fitness, especially now the mental well-being of children. Our farmers for a long time have committed to children. And so when something is going to impede the child's opportunity to get the best nutrition they can, our farmers never stand back. And IDFA, frankly, has been in this battle, a heavy battle with me, 3 different times, including this year, and they've always come through. That's why we're always monitoring this thing, because it does happen. It's just, it's kind of a drag. We don't like the fact that we have to keep spending energy on this, because frankly, if we're spending energy on kids, we want to be proactive energy to get them, you know, feeling better and doing better, especially the challenges they have now. You know, it's kind of a comfort food, milk is, and with the kids and all the coronavirus stuff going on and in and out of schools and masks and not masks, you don't want to be taking away a comfort food at this point. It was just a bad decision. The other Eric Adams issue is, you know, his Vegan Fridays thing that came like a week after they tried to ban chocolate milk.
It was like No Meat Mondays kind of thing.
Yeah, Meatless Mondays. But when they did Meatless Mondays, my staff was able to go into the schools and show them how to replace meat with yogurt and cheese because it's a high protein source. But when they went vegan on Friday, that would eliminate that opportunity. But like I said, for the most part, the school food service directors, who are the practical people on the ground, just found out that, you know, kids were not going to eat. They didn't want a bagel without cream cheese, right? A dry bagel. They didn't, you know, so they actually had to reinstate most of the things that they were trying to get rid of. So once again, still a battle. When the head guy is a vegan, you're going to keep having this crop up.
It'd be fun to play offense, but it seems like a lot of defense. So New York isn't the only state in the Northeast. I'm guessing your organization covers more than just New York. Do you see other the war, if you will, on other fronts? Do other major school districts propose similar things? And do you anticipate more in the future?
We actually are the only loss we've had of any major is D.C. D.C. schools did not do chocolate milk right now. The last time it was brought up, once again, caveat, we don't do legislative, but it was we lost that battle by, I think, 1 council person vote. But they do not have chocolate milk in D.C. public schools. elsewhere, it has popped up regularly, and generally with the help of our nutritionists. We have three nutritionists on staff, and they're very well connected. We've been able to convince the parents and nurses who brought this up that it's not a good decision, but it does keep popping up. Except for DC, we haven't lost any major battles.
I guess on that DC question, how are kids drinking milk? Is there a big difference in consumption patterns in DC with flavored milk not on the menu?
Generally, what we see, and I don't have the DC numbers in front of me, but I know every research project that's been done shows that when you take away chocolate milk, your overall consumption goes down because kids like the variety. I mean, if you look at the fact that there are over 60,000 beverage choices for people these days in grocery stores, et cetera, to limit them to one simple product like that, we need that extra flavor in there to give them a little bit of variety. And so, yeah, generally it hurts consumption. And then that always hurts nutritional well-being because kids cannot replace those 13 essential nutrients very easily by choosing other products.
And my hunch is that they're not, you know, they're getting sugar somewhere else.
Yeah, absolutely. If you this chocolate milk is not the problem for kids, really. There are a lot of other sugar sources out there. And as we talked about before, most of them are not nutrient dense sources. So they're getting mostly sugar and none of the goodness that they get from chocolate milk. And just for your FYI, for you guys, that our biggest challenge with flavored milk now is a lot of schools like New York City does the non-fat chocolate milk. And when we did research at North Carolina State, we found that the biggest area where kids notice a difference was between 1% chocolate and non-fat chocolate. And I believe it's the butterfat probably buffers the bitter taste of the cocoa. Because when we did sugar, same thing, we got below 17 grams or somewhere around there. They didn't like it as much because without the sugar, the bitterness of the cocoa came through again. So that's our biggest challenge right now is trying to, you know, they allowed 1% chocolate. We're trying to get schools to do that as much as possible because we know the kids like that way better than they like the non-fat.
Well, Rick, very interesting stuff. Thank you so much for being on the Dairy Download.
Appreciate it. It's been great. Thanks, guys.
That's a wrap for today's show. As always, we want to thank our production team, Matt Herrick, Michael Gooden, and Andrew Jerome at IDFA, and Corey Romero over here at Bloomington Associates. If you are interested in what Kathleen and I do for our day jobs, check us out at www.dairy.com or ever.ag. Remember, if you enjoy the show, hit the subscribe button and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform.
Thank you to this episode's sponsor, the Kansas Department of Agriculture. Top-ranked transportation and shipping, along with being one of the fastest-growing milk production states, makes Kansas the center of it all. Contact dairyinkansas.com. Thanks for listening to the Dairy Download. Until next time, stay sharp.